Moto Sr., as called Taylor, had four siblings, James or Jimmy, who I believe was the oldest, and I have no clear idea of him. I don't believe that I ever met him, although I know Larson mentioned talking to him. He didn't seem to be walking about where I saw him when we were at Deering. The other brother is younger than Taylor, and that's Don, who died not too many years before 1995, and who died, I believe, in Anchorage. And Mamie and Pearl, I don't know their respective ages, but Mamie is still alive and might be a very good informant, since she was married to Alfred Carman, Taylor's partner in the reindeer herding episode we mentioned, where they stopped in the caves, and probably otherwise too. As far as I know, Taylor gained absolutely nothing from his contributions, nor did other people that I might mention. For instance, his sister Mamie was married to Alfred, and Alfred was very helpful. He was working at or was running the store over at, in the Candle in a mining company, and he was very helpful. If I understand correctly, the Moto, Senior Moto, was a merchant of some success. He competed with the other white merchants, and I'm sure that created some tension. They didn't, Caucasians who went to remote places in Alaska didn't cherish, or even less than you might think, didn't cherish competition, especially not from a non-Caucasian. So Taylor, his mother being a Deering person, being mixed, had the benefit of his father's example, and no doubt working with him in his mercantile operations, and he was very good at relating to people. And Don, was his younger brother, was a very active hunter. These people were all very energetic, lean, energetic people. I believe that Harry Outwater was tied in with Taylor in hunting, because they came out one time and visited me over at Iavik on Chamisso Island, to check on my well-being. And Elsie Black Sukenik, who was the daughter of the roadhouse operators, owners there in the old building in Deering, old two-story roadhouse, was also very helpful. And she worked at the Casa de Paga operations at the Don Stewart's mining operation. He was a superintendent. And all of these things together provided Larson with the means of getting to the cave. I don't think, I may be wrong, that we would have walked the 15 miles or so to the caves. And certainly, if we'd done so, it would not have been very effective, because we could only have gone there and come back within a day or two. We couldn't pack enough to stay there very long. I'd like to say something about the countryside itself. I just touched on it very briefly. As I did say that the impact on the country by humanity was less in that area. Of course, where there was a lot of gold, there was a lot of road building and mining activities that disturbed the country. But in large areas, for instance, up over the pass toward Nome and the pass by down to Nome that passed by Trail Creek, this was mainly just a transit place. and there were no resources that attracted the whites. The prospectors, no doubt, went around and looked there, but were not interested in crystalline limestone. They were looking for hard rock prospects or placer. In the era of the gasoline cat, treaded vehicle, first decades of the century, no doubt, that gave some access, but I didn't see any large areas torn up by, say, a cat running just across mat tundra or wet tundra, anywhere like that, as you would see in the Arctic tundras where the Navy exploration, say, of the oil reserve, PET 4, so-called. When you're walking across Arctic tundras, and we've now gotten away from people doing much walking, it can be a very exhilarating and also very exhausting experience. And I'd like to point out, these are rather perhaps truisms, but they may not be apparent to every person who is going to work in the area, who wants to learn about the area. And that is that the so-called tundras, this mat or knee-high or even waist-high or occasionally higher vegetation that composes these tundras are really quite varied, amazingly so. Every little place has its own little world. And Inupiat had to know all of these habitats because they were trying to exploit them with simple means as best and to make a livelihood, or they could starve. And so they knew what birds and animals would be where, when, not a small stock of knowledge. In the summer, it's not an easy matter to just take off across country with a heavy pack through just any and all kinds of terrain, especially the wetter parts. As we went up with the Go Devil and the Cat in this first 1949 foray, it was very easy for us because after Harry started up the gas cat there at the mine, you had the choice of riding in Helya. He was 44 years old, and he generally sat on the load. But I was at that age, I was 22, and more prone to, and excited perhaps, too excitable. And I wouldn't want to be jostled along by that rough cat. But as you get off the graveled road that leads up to the sort of the headwaters or that feed in the Imnachuk River, it all becomes real, just like floating. However, and when you walk, you go for a few hundred yards or less meters, and the vegetation changes. Here it's thick dwarf birch. Another place it's becomes drier, and there are little plants that are just like walking on a carpet. And there are other plants like blueberries, perhaps, that are little bushes growing around, little dwarf willows. And each place has its wonderful aspect, like a little world, they are. And each has its own smells. When you're going through this brushy tundra, there is a kind of a rosiny smell that exudes, especially if you break the step on vegetation. There's this sort of a rich rosiny smell that arises. And all the plants emit this vapor, sweet-smelling vapor, too, as well. And when you get into areas, some areas will have just a pavement of frost, broken pebbly or pieces, little pieces of rock, and it's very dry and crunchy underfoot, and the only thing you hear is a little wind sounds in your ears. We were walking in shoe packs, and shoe packs are not the most wonderful thing that I recall, but they were the only thing that served the purpose of cushioning your feet that I know of against hard surfaces. They're resilient, and then getting off into puddles and little holes and things you might step in, because in the wetter tundras you could just go along and your foot goes down into a hole and it comes up all muddy and icky and wet, and sometimes you might even go in over the top and then you have a boot full of a wet muck. This is both better and worse than it sounds. as you go along and you move from the creek that flows down to the Kotzebue Sound, suddenly you break up into this more rolling aspect, these ridges and things, and suddenly it just opens up. And I was born in Kansas, in north central Kansas, and I believe that it seemed like I was getting home. There were no great expanses of waving grass, but there wasn't in the 1920s and 30s, there were no great expanses of waving grass. Or there were some beautiful ones, but very rare, on a military reservation. But the country, with its intricate geology, has areas of sedimentary rocks, and it has other areas with other, who knows how many different kinds of strange pieces of Oceania or whatever that drifted in there. And each of these areas has its the way that it's eroded or not eroded in a cold, dry, generally dry climate, even though you have wet feet, it's a dry climate. And time means something different in the Arctic than it does in terms of landscape, certainly. I'm sure that David would fill you in on that. Time has a slow movement often when you look at these landscapes. And the landscapes that you're looking at are the same landscapes, basically, and perhaps exactly, that the earliest people had when they moved from the old world to the new world. So here you are walking in the footsteps of somebody's ancient ancestors. But it looks vast, it is, on the human scale, and there's nothing going on except maybe occasional hawk you see, or your heart flutters when ptarmigans erupt in front of you if they fly. Well, they usually run at that time of year in the summer in among the brush, so they don't usually erupt, but they do sometimes, and that thunderous sound they make makes your heart stop. You look around you, and there was all of this unblemished space, and with many shades of greens and russets and whites, even with rocks, because as we came toward Trail Creek, some of this limey rock, this metamorphosed limestone, was apparent. So we jounced along, and I ran most of the way, probably, or sit down and then get off and then have to run ahead. I get interested in something and have to run ahead to catch up with the go devil. I never lost it entirely. I don't think that he stopped, and he may have stopped sometime. I believe he did, to put in some water. That is, Harry did, that's right, because the cat was quite a run, and I'm not sure where he filled it up, but I remember him stopping to check the water on the old cat. But we knew, Harry knew, that there are not many people had passed this way very recently. Not much reason to. As you break up and get down a ways, then this vista of these ridges and then the drainages down in there. There were some a little willow. There were a few willows down in the drainages, at least at Trail Creek. But head-to-high willows became very rare, or higher than head. And the predominantly were this mosaic, and on the slopes you'd get these areas of wet tundra, and then you get this very dry. And on the top of the of these ridges, extremely dry walking. This was the kind that people could walk around easily, even in the summer. And the other aspect of summer, of course, that discouraged people was the huge numbers of mosquitoes that were like a plague much of the summer until you got frost. We were moving right along, and I believe I used citronella, was still in use. I believe that was the standard. We got it at the store, and we may have had, yes, we did have, I'm wrong about the citronella. That was that really strong stuff that we had from military insect killer. It had sort of a odd, strange, sweet flavoring in it. And it would sting, and you get it in your eyes. It really makes your eyes hurt. But anyway, that was necessary, and some people wore head nets. I didn't. I've talked to a number of people, and it'll come up about places and so on. I think probably that the Inupiat connection with places, this intimate connectiveness to places has been terribly lost, even perhaps among Inupiat, although I hope not, but I get the impression that it has to some degree. But you just feel as if you belong with it. You don't own this, you belong with it. And I felt very much a very deep feeling I think I used the word elation, but it was much more complicated than that, as we came up on the ridge at Trail Creek. And I'd like to point out, in my own background, I don't know enough about Taylor's boyhood, except that he was a mixed ancestry, and that he had the terrible experience in World War II, and that he was married to a Shishmaref lady, and that on her side they were, and on his side they went back centuries and millennia, because the portrait we had from the Iputak site there was somewhere in the area of 1500 years ago, and there was this person who looked just like a modern person, Ben Aden or Ben Agapuk, a relative, I believe, by marriage of Taylor's. I had no such connections, but I felt a marvelous connectiveness to these places, because I've always had a connectiveness to landscape. And this comes from my background, I suppose. I depended for my survival in the early years upon my grandparents. And my earliest memory is of being inside a limestone, cut limestone house in northeastern Kansas, would have been a little ways from Hiawatha, which was formerly Indian, is now Caucasian mainly. This was an older, not a recently built, but an old one, and the people had sawn, as they did in Kansas, this soft limestone in blocks, thick. The walls must have been a couple of feet thick, really substantial. And there weren't very many windows. Like older houses, they didn't have that much light coming in them, and so you got near the window if you wanted to read or look out. And I would look out. As a boy, I remember one of my earliest experiences, and one of the most profoundly emotional experiences, was looking out of this window, watching the barn, and to see my grandfather coming. He came carrying a bucket of milk in each hand from milking. And when this was winter time, and when he came in, after he put the milk down, he came in to warm up, and he sat down and picked me up by this window, this stone window. I was had been standing on a chair looking out through this not very large window with the with those old-style panes of not very perfect glass, and waiting and hoping that Grandpa would come and pick me up, which he did. So I have this very deep attachment to limestone. And the limestone is very interesting because they take saws and they saw, this kind is, I guess it's Cretaceous or whatever. Anyway, it's soft, relatively, as stones go, and it can be sawn with a saw. And they would cross-cut saw, or was it one man, I'm not sure. And they just saw it and then cut the blocks, and then when it's exposed to the air, it hardens. It's a gorgeous, creamy white, usually, in its natural state, and then it darkens with age to of a brown, more brownish, and it varies from place to place according to the amount of iron, I suppose. But looking out of this house, it would be like living in a cave, wouldn't it? I didn't plan this. This was just fate, I think. And limestone has a sweet smell, and it's hard to describe. It's the opposite of acidic, which twinkles your nose, but limestone has a sweet smell. And when you come to Trail Creek, it has a sweet smell, not so much when you're standing. I mean, the wind is carrying the vegetation smells. But when you get down and lie down, everything smells sweet, sweetly. And where there is limestone growing, right where the plants can get their roots into it, or into the fragments of it, the plants are intensely green. I don't know why that is. But at Trail Creek, these Dreas mats with other lowbush cranberry and blackberry, common names, this little mat that you'd sit down or lie on and try to find a place where a rock wasn't projecting into your flesh was a very sweet smelling. I don't believe that the rocks had that much smell. Nevertheless, I guess when they were broken apart, remember, these are very ancient and metamorphosed. They've been put under pressure and are very crystalline. So I don't know whether that changes the smell. I think it does. But anyway, the Trail Creek smells sweetly and was intensely green. And then the flowers, though they were teeny, tiny things, were very brave looking and very healthy looking. They were only 2 inches above the above the mat. The Dreas flowers are beautiful little, remember, the rosaceae, I believe, and they're beautiful white petals. And then when the petals are blown away in the wind, as they would be there in the creek, then there's a little tuft of that's left in the center, and this becomes a somewhat cottony, I believe, as the seed matures. I could lie there on the slopes, or try to find a sort of more or less level place when I'm through work or other times, and look out over the south all around, and there was a different aspect everywhere you looked, and the light is so wonderful, and so clean. When you look south, you see this pretty good-sized canyon. It isn't extremely eroded, I mean, with rock banks, or there's some soils, but as you look up over unto the south, there's this just the edge of the lava flows that are, you see the dark brown edge of this that has been eroded away. I suppose it forms a canyon of Cottonwood Creek and then Trail Creek that it heads into it, that turns, makes almost a right turn. And the creek comes around. It was right around the end of the ridge down there, and it's wonderful. You can go to 100 other places in land that hasn't been improved by people, and you'll see thousand different aspects that are beautiful. That's the way nature is, and it's no less varied in the Arctic. It's just the time scale is different, and the creatures, the number of species is reduced, but it's extremely varied in its aspects. Extremely. Some people would say, this all looks alike to me. They'd say, what could you use this for? Isn't that something? Of course, the missionaries thought it would be good for reindeer herding, and it was, until they ran it into the ground, and the Eskimos, moreover, didn't like to spend all their time out there pounding around after a reindeer, like Laplanders did. So that eventually, between social factors and biological factors, there went that big idea of having reindeer. Just as well, too. And the gold miners, too, they would like to tear up the whole country. But not really. I mean, they don't want to tear it up, but they want to get all the gold that's there. And so all of the terraces and stream beds, if miners were given their total free rein, I suppose, would be eventually mined, turned over and churned up. But I don't think they will be. I hope not. This is not to say that mining has not benefited people, although I think its long-term impact will be, except on the land. You see, these things will last hundreds or thousands of years, the changes of the landscape, but as far as people's benefits are very short-term locally, and the men who came there just died off, usually without being terribly well off. Northern lands have a way of chastening people who get too uppity. This is October 19th, 1995, and I'd like to add a few speculative comments about the uses of Trail Creek. And I realize that Inupiat are very reluctant to speculate, and when they did, it was on a lot better footing than I have. Nevertheless, maybe I'll think of some utilitarian and other uses of the caves that someone else hasn't thought of. One of us is obvious from our knowledge of technology, and that would be for a winter shelter. And I didn't write down at least whether Taylor and Alfred blocked the entrance, hung a tarp there, skins or anything at the time. Taylor probably said, and I simply forgot to write it down. But you could also use, and I'm pretty sure that in the historic and prehistoric times, the hunters that went there in winter for shelter in storms, or for other reasons that were back in the caves, would use a stone lamp or a wooden lamp, a hunter's lamp, which we know was used historically in the Sound area. And people stopping in the caves also would have access to hollowed out rocks, those formed by waters, you know, water solution, by a solution process, hollowing out of stones, could improvise lamps in the caves, or they could keep one there in case they came back again. If one introduces a great deal of heat, a monstrous amount of heat, such as I did one time, into the cave on somebody's instructions, then you do find a hazard of rocks falling from a fractured ceiling or walls, because the caves have been subjected apparently to this exfoliation process or breaking off process. But with normal body heat and the small amount of heat provided by a lamp or stone lamps, that would not be a problem. Their fuel could come from caribou fat if they were just in wintertime. They're from caribou fat or marrow fat. And so that's a strong possibility. Well, use of the caves at other times of the year is not only possible, but probable. Say that somebody is going on the trail, which really it's a natural along the trail, which the gold miners used, and it was also gives is the, on the trail to inland and back to the Imnichuk, the Deering area. So people might say in rainy weather in summer might be soaked and just stop in to try to collect themselves and dry out a little bit. And an alternative might be in summer that they were walking and were so thirsty because water can be quite scarce in the uplands there, drinkable water in summer when there's a dry spell, so that you would have either the water collected down in the creek, or and you also have that large snowbank, which would be attractive to people. And perhaps, well, I don't know, bears' habits, but maybe that would be an element in, for them too. Use of the of some of the caves for winter meat storage or storage of hunting implements seems to me quite probable, and would be quite feasible in several of these the ones I call sort of hanging caves, and the. Deering people, for instance, and the South Coast people of Kotzebue Sound, historically, and you can be sure prehistorically, were quite adept at climbing rocks, and they, if need be, they use ropes